one. The first case for today is United States v. Gilmore. Good morning, Mr. Graham.
Good morning. May it please the court,
counsel. I had saved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure. They've got it.
Great. This case below, obviously you've all read the briefs. The issue on it, or several of the issues that I'd like to address today, one of which is that the prosecutor below pushed the judges, the trial judge's ruling, until it broke. Prosecutor Ryan went ahead and pushed this and literally obliterated the judge's pretrial ruling in this case.
Let's just start right out here, because let's assume that the prosecutor deliberately, violated the court's order to exclude the reference to prison. Assume that he wanted the jury to know that Martin had been in prison, because this would help the government win the trial. How is that relevant to the question of the prosecutor's intent to terminate the trial? What possible advantage can be obtained by terminating the trial after opening statements?
The intent was never to go ahead and terminate trials, period. The intent here was to go ahead and get a second trial and, in the interim, go ahead and change the trial court's ruling. Let's look at a couple of things. The prosecutor in this case went ahead and violated the court's ruling on three occasions. On the other hand, there were 13 to 15 other references where he talked about Martin being away. And in those references, he talked about how long, or there was an implied reference as to how long Martin was away, from the late 80s or 90s through 1998. These are repeated references throughout the prosecutor's opening statement. And the intent here was to go ahead and change the trial court's ruling on
it. But even if the prosecutor violated the court's ruling in order to persuade the court to change its ruling, that is different from intending to terminate the trial.
Absolutely
and
true.
And doesn't Oseni make clear that for double jeopardy purposes, the only relevant intent is the intent to terminate the trial?
Right. That's absolutely accurate. But the issue here is whether or not he was pushing things to the extent of going ahead and intending to get a mistrial in this case.
Well, is it your view that there would have been then another mistrial and then another mistrial?
No. There was an issue here that was raised between the end of the first trial and the second trial that never began, and that was to change the court's ruling. If you look at the reasoning that Prosecutor Ryan gave immediately...
Before we get into that, friend, the judge made a finding of fact, did she not?
She did.
That there was no such intent on the part of the prosecutor.
That's accurate.
So what do we do with that?
Well, the question on it is, and Oseni brought this up, is whether or not it's reasonable or plausible. And so I think we have to look at the reasoning he gave.
We have to determine that what you said was both unreasonable, or either unreasonable or implausible, or both.
That's my guess.
Okay.
See, and the problem is, I'm sorry, Judge Bob.
I just want to know what game we were playing.
And the problem is here that, you know, there were 10 or 11 references, as has been discussed, where there was no reference made to the fact that he was in prison. And so when you talk about the court's view and looking at whether it was reasonable, the court really did weigh that. And that's the problem in terms of attacking that finding,
I think. Those references, in conjunction with the three references that Martin was in jail, just go ahead and exacerbate the situation. So if you look at this, it's almost like there were 15 or 16 references to Martin being in jail. That's why I started this argument by saying that they obliterated the judge's pretrial ruling. If you also look at what Mr. Ryan said immediately after and what his reasons were, he basically said the following. I think I had expressed the difficulties of trying to do that, which means going ahead and doing this argument and going ahead and complying with the court order. We're in a situation here where we have a debate as to whether or not a trial court's order is to be gone ahead and complied with or not. The second thing he said was that it's very artificial meaning that the jury would understand this anyway. And the third of which is, I get the sense that probably many of the jurors would understand what was going on because it was so intricately related. Well, the point in the district court's ruling was that this information was absolutely barred. It was not to be gotten into. And Judge Pallmeyer went.
You think that's a deadly accurate ruling? You think that's appropriate?
Well, what she did was she went ahead and ruled on this regarding 403.
Yeah, I understand what she did, but I'm curious as to whether or not, since we're analyzing what she has done in terms of her analysis of what the motivation of the prosecution, how about the correctness of the ruling itself?
I think the district court always has the ability to determine whether or not something is so prejudicial.
Do we get to look at that, too?
That's not an issue that I see that's on appeal.
I didn't think it would be.
Those are the things that the judge basically went ahead and said. When she said that she wanted this issue barred, she wanted it barred because, number one, she felt it was very prejudicial. And number two, in her ruling, she was talking about the fact that she did not want the jury throughout the entire trial wondering why Mr. Martin was in custody.
Of course, we only look at the cold record, but she didn't seem to be as outraged as one would imagine if there had been some sort of violation, as you argue.
I can't really speak to whether or not the judge should have been or shouldn't have been more outraged.
Or was outraged.
Excuse me?
She doesn't appear to be outraged.
That's true. The other thing is that the one thing that the prosecutor goes ahead and adopts in his brief is that they only basically had 4 days to go ahead and restructure their opening to adopt these changes. We as trial lawyers go ahead and make these kinds of changes on a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour basis. 4 days is an awful long time, and if that's the standard that we're basically going to adopt.
You're ready for a murder case in 4 days.
I have been, but usually that's not the practice.
Look at how experienced you are now, Mr. Graham.
Well, I thank you for the compliment,
vis-a-vis
Judge.
The younger.
Judge, I don't think there's anything on the record as to how much experience Prosecutor Ryan has, and I think that's one of the issues as to whether or not it should be remanded, and some of those issues should come up. Obviously, in Joliak, we had a situation where this was the prosecutor's very first trial. That's a whole, or it may be a whole different situation than we have here. I'll save the rest of my time for
Thank
rebuttal.
You. Okay.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Jake Ryan for the United States. Your Honor.
A courageous man. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, double jeopardy does not bar retrying a defendant after a mistrial where the defendant asked for the mistrial. This rule applies unless the prosecutor intentionally provoked the mistrial. In this case, Judge Pallmeyer found that I did not intentionally provoke the mistrial when I referred to the fact that...
As a matter of idle curiosity, did you?
Well, Your Honor, that's not in the record, of course. But I know I did not. No, I did not.
How many trials have you had?
About 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm. Oh, attaboy.
At that point, you had 8 or 9?
Yes, Your Honor. It was just a few months ago. We're on an expedited basis
for
this appeal.
I know.
It's just, you know, hard. 3 slips is sort of hard to swallow. You know, references to him being in jail.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand that. Judge Pallmeyer, who was listening to the opening statement that I gave, made that finding that they were inadvertent references. They were in the context of several proper references. I think that the court noted when she made the finding that the ruling was fairly recent. We had argued that it was very central to the story, Mr. Martin's incarceration. They arose, the references that I made, in the context of explaining how the Mafia Insane Vice Lord street gang was formed. He, of course, formed the gang when he was in prison. The district judge, the way that the district judge arrived at the finding was reasoned, and it was a considered judgment.
I mean, the sense I get from your brief and the argument is that you found it very difficult to live with the court's order, and that you think the witnesses will find it difficult to live with the court's order. And so, you know, if this goes back and there's no finding that this was intentional and your intent was to terminate the trial, you know, do we expect that if this trial goes forward again that we would have the same situation?
Your Honor,
wouldn't be able to constrain or restrain yourself.
We will take every prophylactic measure that we can.
The British usually call a prison a university. You could get them at university if you want to, I suppose.
You know, the district judge didn't make a ruling on whether the trial was going well for the government at the time of the action that precipitated the mistrial, did she?
Your Honor, she did not explicitly, although I think that in the context of what was going on in the trial, I think that was apparent.
Well, to you.
I think I would respect.
What does that mean when she doesn't do it explicitly?
Well, I would respectfully submit to the judge, the Oseni is a two-step process. I immediately admitted that it was inadvertent, said it was a mistake. It really wasn't an issue raised. At the time, the judge said it was so early in the trial and the ruling was recent that she said at one point, I think in the record, the misconduct wasn't intentional. I don't think anybody argues that it was intentional. She made her ruling. She reiterated her ruling again the following day. So I think that the idea that it was a snap judgment is incorrect.
Well, once again, I say to you that she didn't make a ruling on whether the trial was going well, and what I'm wondering is, do we need to send this back for her to make that judgment?
Winter, I would respectfully submit that it was early enough in the trial that it was obvious to the trial judge that the trial was hardly going.
The openings were finished.
That's right, Your Honor.
That's a pretty big part of a trial. I think statistics show that many jurors make up their minds, even though they're not supposed to, after the openings.
Well, Your Honor, I would note that the defendants did not ask for a hearing at the time. There was no mention of a hearing until later.
So you believe they forfeited any request for such a hearing?
Well, that's the government's argument. That's
yes.
The government's first argument, that it was forfeited because the idea of a hearing was never raised with the district judge. The district judge down below was never offered that option. But even if the court finds that it wasn't forfeited, the standard is abuse of discretion to determine whether the district judge should have had a hearing. There's no indication in the record that she abused her discretion by failing to hold a hearing. She, as I mentioned earlier, made the decision. She thought about it over lunch, made the finding that that it was an inadvertent reference. The issue was raised again in the context of the motion to dismiss for double jeopardy. She reiterated her finding. She said, "I was listening to the opening. My clear impression, I have said it, I don't need to repeat it, was that this was a slip of the tongue. I even thought that based upon Mr. Ryan's demeanor, apart from the flow of the argument." So she had sufficient time to think about the opening statement that I gave and the context of the references that I made. Thank you, Your Honor.
Of course, let me ask you this. Of course, holding a hearing would have cleared up a few of the questions that we have, wouldn't it? It would have been a better course.
It would have, Your Honor, but if you look at Oseni, and you'll see the two-step process that the court must use, the district court must use to determine whether a hearing is appropriate, that was satisfied in this case.
No. Oseni, if I might be so bold, if the action that precipitated mistrial, look, if the trial had been going well for the prosecution, when the action that precipitated the mistrial occurred, then the court can accept the prosecutor's explanation and deny the defendant's motion for acquittals without holding an evidentiary hearing. That's the second part of Oseni. That's what we've got to really mull over here.
I understand, Your Honor.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
Just a few points, if I could. Obviously, if you look at Oseni, it was remanded for a hearing. And I think that there is a distinction factually between that and Joeyak. And in Oseni, it was a prosecutor's intent. It was not a witness's intent. Oftentimes, what happens in this kind of thing is that there is a cross-examination or a direct examination, and during that time, something slips out, and it's a witness that does it. But obviously, Judge Posner in the Oseni case looked at this a little differently, and that was that there was a prosecutor that was a witness on the stand who went ahead and disclosed some information regarding that was not supposed to be disclosed during a motion to suppress. In this case, we have that same kind of intent that's an issue. It is a prosecutor's intent. It is not a witness's intent. It is not that kind of a mistake. There was no issue whatsoever that this was to be barred from the opening and any witness's testimony. The judge went through extreme measures to ensure that was done, and obviously it was violated repeatedly. We think that it should be remanded for a hearing. The other thing...
Even though there was no request by defense counsel for a hearing at the time.
Well, let's talk about that. There was a motion that was filed, and the same issues that we have here were the kind of issues that were brought up in that motion. And additionally, that motion specifically asked for a timeout to basically go ahead and look at the record. And if there wasn't time to get a written copy of it, to go ahead and look at the oral, that would have gone ahead and made a determination that there were, in fact, three violations versus the two that were understood below. Neither the prosecutor nor the judge addressed all three violations. There wasn't knowledge down below that there were three violations, only two violations. So what we'd be left with here is we don't even know which violations the prosecutor was speaking to or the judge was speaking to, and as a result of it, we have a very inadequate record, and we'd ask for a remand for that issue.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finn. Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Case will be taken under advisement. Thank you. We'll go on to